Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Well, our listeners are in for, I don't know if I'd call it a treat, Jody, but we're, you know, we've each had some things happen with a couple of publications and talks recently, and we're going to spend the next two episodes kind of covering the ground that we covered in those articles. I guess I'll start with those as kind of the anchor point. Looking back at the latest edition of the Appellate Advocate, published by the State Bar Appellate section, each one of us had articles in that spring, I think it was the spring 2026 issue. Mine was on the new petition for review system, and yours with the ever so cheeky dad joke title was on supersedious bonds. I just have to give the title now. The title of your paper was The Name's Bonds, Supersedious Bonds. I can never pull that stuff off, man. I like how you name your papers.
Well, you gotta have a good joke in it to make a good CLE paper, I feel like. Well, I mean, especially I don't know if it's a good joke. It's a joke.
Especially on the topic of supersedious bonds, which is sometimes
super enthralling.
Listening to that is like, you know, watching paint dry sometimes. But
no, it is.
But it is a very important topic. No denying it. I think both are very timely from the standpoint of things that, you know, practitioners who are facing judgments or petitions need to know about. So what we decided to do was we're going to spend an episode today talking about your topic, supersedious. Uh-huh. And then when we come back later in July, we're going to spend an episode further exploring my topic, the new petition for review system. And one reason we're going to do that is because, unlike some of our other rule change episodes we've done recently, we didn't come back and do a recap after the final rules were adopted. And there are a few things to talk about and some recent developments that we're tracking and want to talk to listeners about. So, but I'm going to put a pin in the new petition for review system, and we're going to spend the rest of our time together today talking about supersedious. So I can't wait. Let's dive in.
All right.
What's new in supersedious, Jody?
Well, that's the thing. We've had several episodes on this. We've got Dan Huckabee come on and talk mm-hmm. about it. I know I've talked about it. So I think if you want to know generally kind of the lay of the land on supersedious, you can look back to some of our old episodes on those topics, which I think give different perspectives. I know Arturo Ayala came a little mm-hmm. bit more recently. So, I mean, we have a lot of those things already in the can. And I guess the two newest things in Texas are alternative security, and I'll talk about that and the rule change, and then also the Graystar case from the Texas Supreme Court, which answered one question that's kind of been floating around Texas law for a while and then left open another one that I think is going to be an interesting question as we see how that case gets, or other cases go forward based on that ruling. So yeah, I published this article in The Advocate around the same time that I did a CLE presentation at the UT appellate course, which was a couple of weeks ago in Austin. So I'm not going to give the speech, but I think I'm going to kind of use some of the ideas from that to talk about some of these things. You know, Texas and federal both have supersedious rules. They're a little bit different. I think federal is pretty straightforward, and I can talk about in a minute kind of what federal requires. Texas has a lot more paths that you can go down, and I think that's where we'll spend most of our time, because it's the one that I think is the most interesting and probably prevalent to practitioners, because there just aren't as many civil trials in federal courts or things that have to be bonded necessarily. Right. But in Texas, you know, I'm not going to rehash our old episodes, but there's basically four ways to supersede. You can have an agreement with the other side. You can post a bond. You can do a deposit of cash or a check, or you can do alternative security. Those are the big four. It's in Rule of Appellate Procedure 24.
Right.
I think the big takeaway on all of those is, at the moment you know that you might need to do it, start looking at your options, because especially if your business or individually you have complicated finances, if you're going to get a bond, the underwriting process takes time. If you're going to do a deposit, sometimes that takes time to come up with the non-liquid assets. And especially if you're going to try and do alternative security, when we get to that in a minute, there's several different things that you may have to prove and show, and it's going to take a while to put all that together into a package. And then on top of that, get a hearing date, because for that type of security, you've got to have a hearing and an order from the judge. So bonds are pretty straightforward, and you can go back to our other episodes with Dan and Arturo on what that looks like. But I think if you're a practitioner, the things to make sure you get right are, what's the amount, which mm-hmm. I'll kind of explain what those are. Make sure that the sureties are actually good and sufficient sureties. In federal court, a lot of the courts, if you look at their local rules, have a list of approved sureties. And Texas has a list of approved sureties, but you can also get a bond in Texas that isn't a commercial surety. And so I know in my practice, I don't know about yours, a couple of times over the years, someone has come up with a surety and you look a little bit deeper and realize this isn't really a surety. Maybe it's the parent company that owns 100% of the judgment debtor stock, and that's the only asset right. that they have, you know. So do check who the sureties are on either side. Make sure that it's done correctly. And if you don't think it is, and you're the judgment creditor, go challenge it. A couple of things to think about. Number one, I mentioned this earlier, the process takes a time, and it can take a lot of time if you're complicated finances, because they've got to go through all of that stuff. They want to look at it, and they want to make sure what their underwriting requirements are met. So give them time, give them information, and alert your client that they're probably going to need a lot of fairly sensitive financial documents. Mm-hmm. You know, the costs run generally, and this is very broad, like 1-3% a year on the face amount of the bond. And that's what you're paying to the bond company. On top of that, a lot of them will require a letter of credit, and there's additional fees for that. So just bear that in mind too. And then this is one of the places where Texas and federal law differ. In federal law, you can actually get your bond premiums back mm-hmm. as a cost if you prevail on appeal. In Texas, you can't. And I know I've said this before on this show, but I'll continue to say it till someone listens to me. The Texas legislature really needs to think seriously about changing the law to allow that in Texas, because I sincerely think that that will eliminate a huge percentage of the litigation and satellite litigation we have over supersedious. Because once you're looking down as the other side, spending all the money it requires to respond and fight these things, and on top of it, having the potential that you may have to give back 10 or hundreds of thousands of dollars in bond premiums as a cost, I think this goes away in large part. So I hope that one day the legislature will consider that.
Yeah, I want to explore that a little bit, because, you know, we see overall in our appellate rules and things that are happening at the Supreme Court, Texas Supreme Court these days, you know, we've seen an increasing sort of federalization of our approach to appellate issues. Some procedural, some maybe substantive. This is kind of, you know, a hybrid situation where there's a procedural aspect of it, but in the end, it definitely affects somebody's rights at the end of an appeal. Mm-hmm. If the costs are going to be recoverable, you know, in a significant case, as you indicate, I mean, the premium alone can be quite expensive. And so you think about, you know, we have these rules and have for many years that allow supersedious based on net worth and some other special situations that you're going to get into. But, you know, it just does. I will agree with you, and I'll echo what you say about, it seems like the law ought to be uniform on that. And I know from what little federal work I do, that bond premium factor is a major consideration in deciding on how things should get handled. And the other sort of trap in satellite litigation is all the litigation over net worth. Mm-hmm. And it's always a little, I'll just say, interesting to me that, you know, if someone's going in and arguing that they don't have sufficient net worth, or that, you know, their judgment should be superseded based on their net worth, and their net worth is negative, that they might have some, you know, fairly expensive appellate lawyer arguing that position for them. Mm-hmm. It does sort of raise questions about, you know, the veracity of that position. But I'm all for trying to simplify it. And so I think that's a really good point about the bond premium. The other thing you said, or I think we've talked about before on the podcast, is, you know, if in doubt, this is a good time to pick up the phone and talk to opposing counsel. Mm-hmm. It can be a conversation about the sufficiency of the surety. It can be a conversation about some other alternate security that might help avoid some of the things that you're talking about. But, you know, we do so much of our work on screen, and we're not even on the phone as much anymore, it doesn't seem like, much less in person. So this is a great, great opportunity. We've touted before on the show, to actually engage with your opposing counsel and see what you can get done before that judgment is signed, or shortly after the judgment is signed, so that your client's position's not jeopardized by possibly facing execution on the judgment.
That's right. And I get it. Look, it's a huge leverage hammer to put over someone's head. the cost and specter of having to supersede a judgment. But I've also seen cases where maybe, for instance, you settle this issue by the judgment creditor paying, I don't know, some amount to the other side on this that they're not going to get back. So, I mean, whether it's a, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, in the right case, you pay that to them and then it avoids everyone having to run up fees on this and have all the fights. Mm-hmm. And you just agree that that's, you know, I don't know. And of course, some of that also depends on the financial condition of the debtor. And like you said, I've seen cases where, you know, they say, oh, well, gosh, our net worth is negative and, you know, we could never be bothered to post a bond. And yet somehow all the bills are getting paid. And so there is a little bit of sussing out the veracity of that. And I get it, but I think in the types of disputes where you really don't have those fights, you're just kind of fighting over the amount and the ability, having something like a cost recovery for premiums can kind of even the playing field and diffuse some of those disputes. But that's just, I'm going to keep preaching that. We'll see if anyone ever actually takes me up on it.
Well, we've got the platform right here.
Well, so that's right.
Keep talking about it because it is important.
Appellate courts have demanding procedural requirements. That's why you need an expert who understands the complexities of every court nationwide. Since 1938, Counsel Press has been the trusted partner of the AmLaw 100, providing unmatched expertise in appellate services from e-brief preparation to electronic filing. Their team manages document review and compliance, ensuring your appeals in expert hands from start to finish. Counsel Press, your trusted partner in every appeal. Visit counselpress.com today.
Were you going to talk about calculation under the federal rules as opposed to our state rules?
Yeah, I will in a minute. Okay. I was just going to kind of touch briefly on a couple things that I think are just worth remembering for the other types. For deposits, deposits are pretty straightforward. The only thing that I'll raise here is first, check the interest rates because every district clerk has different types of accounts. Some of them keep a fee for holding that amount. So just see what they are. And if you've got a client that's trying to decide between that and a supersedious bond, check with a supersedious bond broker because sometimes they may have higher interest rate accounts and you can, you know, recover some of the differential despite the cost. So I would just say, think about that. The other thing is Texas has changed the rule on records where if you post some sort of supersedious, you have to put that in the clerk's record. If you're just depositing a check or cash or wiring money, whatever it is, you're not actually filing anything. So just do like a one-page certificate of filing saying on this date I did it. So then you've got something that can be in the record. Alternative security, I do want to spend a minute here. So there's always been alternative security in Texas. It just was not real clear what it was and the trial court had a lot of discretion. And having read the cases, I think generally speaking, the idea is some sort of unencumbered non-cash asset that the debtor holds that can potentially satisfy the judgment or at least satisfy the supersedious requirements. I mean, think land. You know, if you have a client that has a lot of land that's not unencumbered by a mortgage or something, that is an asset, but it's not an asset that's necessarily a cash asset that they can readily leverage and deposit. But if you put that up or you put deeds of trust on a couple of properties, you may get to that point. The only thing to remember is a bond and a deposit are effective when you file. That stays the judgment. You can go get writs of supersedious. You can stop all those efforts. If you're going to do alternative security, you actually have to have an order from the court on that. So give yourself time because you can't just show up and throw some deeds of trust into the court registry and be good. You've got to actually go through that. And valuation can be a little bit trickier too, because if it's a non-cash asset like real estate, well, how do you value for potential fluctuations? That kind of thing. So just think about that. But where we do have a new rule, there's now two types of alternative security. There's just this sort of overarching alternative security as an option in the rules. But then there's this new provision in 24.2E that's a specific type of alternative security. So it's a mandatory rule. The trial court has to allow it if you have a judgment debtor that has $10 million or less in net worth, and they have to substantially liquidate their assets to post security for the bond. And if you satisfy those and you convince the trial court, it has to let you post something, and you as the debtor actually get to manage and keep that income during the time. So the property is leveraged as alternative security, whatever it is, but whatever income is produced off of it, say it's a piece of land, if there's leases, if there's, you know, cattle, whatever you're running, you get to keep and manage that and operate your business. So take a look at that rule. And the Supreme Court has said this didn't eliminate the old alternative security. This is a very specific type that's applicable in this situation. But that doesn't mean you can't post alternative security if you have greater than $10 million in net worth and other things. But they coexist. Not really any case law on it so far, but just be aware it's out there. But there are two things to think about. Number one, you have to prove what your net worth is. And I'll kind of get into how you do that later. So that's one showing that you're going to have to make. And then number two, you have to show the value and also that you'd have to substantially liquidate the assets in the ordinary course of business. So it's an option and just keep it in the back of your mind and kind of keep an eye on case law because I'm interested to see where that's going to go.
Is that essentially targeting the land rich and cash poor types that we've talked about some before?
I think it is, although I think it may have also maybe swept into that ambit some things like cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
You know, think about, I mean, again, cryptocurrency is something that's got value. It's certainly fluctuating value, but if someone's got substantial amounts of cryptocurrency, that's potentially an alternative security.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't know. But yes, I think to answer your question, the idea was somebody who might have a lot of land that's unencumbered, you know, a big ranch or farmland or something, but they don't necessarily have the cash to shell out. They can use that and continue to manage and keep the income.
I hadn't thought about the cryptocurrency angle, but that actually makes a lot of sense. Something yeah. it's hard to value, just like land.
Yeah. It is. Well, it's hard to value and it fluctuates. I think that's what we've seen in the last couple of years is it can fluctuate very rapidly in different ways. So I think, again, when you're valuing that kind of stuff, whichever side of the V you're on, just think about how you value that and how you calculate a judgment amount that leaves room for that, because right. I think there will be fluctuation. Federal courts, you mentioned this. It's a little bit more straightforward than it is in Texas state court. You've got to go to the district judge. They get to figure out the amount. They get to figure out how you do it. They have to approve it. There's a lot of local rules, like the Eastern District of Texas has a local rule that says you're surety amount is 120% of the judgment. So
yeah,
it's just sort of face value. So check your local rules. The Fifth Circuit has the opportunity to review those types of decisions, but generally you're going to have to go to the district judge first. So just, I think, be prepared in federal court. You're probably going to post the face amount plus some additional percentage, which is effectively what we do in Texas with interest, estimated interest, but it's
right.
the whole amount, which is not how we do it here. So
yeah, I'm always reminded that 120% of the judgment includes punitive damages and I think attorney's fees too. Unlike
pre-judgment interest, all that stuff. Yeah. So I do want to spend a few minutes talking about that because I think in Texas, the way that you calculate how much is different and it's significantly different and it's worth exploring a little bit. So in Texas, it's a little bit trickier. Number one, it depends on the type of judgment. So for a money judgment is, I think, where people spend most of the time litigating these issues because it's what comes up the most. Texas has several different cascading types of maximum amounts depending on what it is. So basically, if it's a money judgment, the most that you have to put up regardless is $25 million. And I mentioned the Graystar case that came out, we're now in mid-June, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and Graystar finally decided a question that's been percolating, which is the $25 million applies per debtor. Because the question was, is it $25 million by everyone in the case, and that's cap per judgment, or is it solely by debtor? Supreme Court and Graystar said it's per debtor. So every debtor has to post up to $25 million, regardless of, you know, any of the other things. And so if it's a $100 million judgment, each one of them's got to post $25 million. What Graystar, I don't think, decided, and where I think it's going to be an interesting question, is what happens if you have, say, related defendants who want to do a joint bond? What do you do when they each have to post $25 million, but that might leave the judgment creditor oversecured? And there's kind of a fight between the justices in the Graystar opinion and the Graystar, I think it was a concurrence or dissent, about what that looks like and whether you're actually oversecuring them. So if you're going to do a joint bond, read it carefully, think about how you condition it, talk to the surety, see what they want to do, because you can still do a joint bond. It's just a little bit more complicated to figure out how you put in the language to make sure that everyone feels protected, both the creditor, that they get full value from each of the judgment debtors, but also the judgment debtors and the surety so that they're not oversecuring somebody. So that's kind of my takeaways on Graystar.
What generally, like what situations would you have a joint bond posted in? It's like related defendants or like vicarious liability situations, maybe?
I think probably some of that. Yeah, I mean, think about it. If you have, for instance, a dispute where you have maybe a parent company and a subsidiary, they probably have the same insurance tower. They probably mm-hmm. have the same sureties. Or, you know, I think you're right. Some more related defendants. Maybe they family members. I don't know. Or it could just be all the defendants on one side. It might be all of the defendants just decided that it made more economic sense to post a single bond and share the premiums. I don't know. But it's a little less clear the mechanics of that after Graystar. So I would spend some time looking at that.
And that is truly a down in the weeds nerdy
issue. Yeah, it is 100%. You know, the easiest way is if you do it now, you know, at the end of the day, the most your client's going to have to put up for a money judgment is $25 million. And so
right.
Do you go it alone? Do you try and work it out together? You know, maybe some company has a preferential rate with their insurance bonding company and they can get a supersedious bond for a lot cheaper. I don't know, but just it is an option. It just, we'll see where it goes from there. So that's the maximum amount. But Texas also allows for the lesser of half of your net worth or $25 million. So if you have a client whose net worth is less than $50 million in a big judgment, you can post that amount or in any case. So that's another way to do it. How that comes about is trickier because you have to bear the burden of proof on that. I mean, the $25 mm-hmm. million dollar cap is very straightforward. It's $25 million. The 50% of the net worth, you actually have to put on affirmative proof in the form of an affidavit. And the affidavit's got to have a pretty detailed listing of the debtor's assets minus their liabilities to come to a net worth amount. And once you have that laid out, then you post 50% of that amount.
Mm-hmm.
My suggestion is in something that's not, you know, your average person in your average household finances, maybe you can post your own net worth affidavit. It's not a big deal. But if it's a company, if it's anything like that, the case law standard is assets minus liabilities under generally accepted accounting principles. Think about getting a CPA to do it for what, whether it's for an individual with anything complicated, for a business, because they can take net worth discovery. And the first question they're going to ask that person is about generally accepted accounting principles. Yeah. And I sure don't know what they are. I mean, I've done a lot of these, but you just think about if you need an expert to do it, because it really does
save a lot of time. I've seen it done both ways. If I'm the one, you know, putting up the affidavit, I always want a CPA. And over time, I've used a few, and it seems like I don't know if it's me or if it's just, it's gotten a little bit harder to find these folks that actually are willing to subject themselves mm-hmm. to being cross-examined.
Well, I don't blame them.
I don't either, but, you know, I'll just say that if there was somebody out there that was a CPA that did this kind of thing, you know, you could spend a fair amount of time doing expert work on net worth and litigation consulting, I think, because there's definitely a need for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't found anyone locally. Some of the folks that I was using don't do it anymore for various reasons. And so that's a quandary I get into, you know, maybe about once a year, every other year
mm-hmm.
of who's going to swear to this, talking to the client right. about it. Because you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, you've got a guy that maybe has a BA in business administration who's talking about generally accepted accounting principles. He's going to get scared about what he knows about mm-hmm. GAAP for sure. But I love the net worth rule. It's another great nerdy mm-hmm. appellate rule. But one thing that I think sometimes gets lost on people in the application of that rule is, you know, with that affidavit, you file it. Judgment's superseded.
Yep.
All execution efforts have to stop. So
that's right.
No post judgment discovery, no receivership, no garnishment. You know, basically the only thing you cannot prevent or you don't prevent by filing a net worth affidavit, subject to the contest, of course, and a later ruling from the court, is you can't prevent an abstracted judgment.
That's right.
From being filed, and that so you know it won't untangle the mess that an abstract can cause if the judgment a debtor wants to go and try and sell property, but it will keep, at least for the time being, at least it will keep the sheriff away from your door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does, and so it's an important tool, and it's one to think about because if you can do it, it saves a lot of time and effort on some of these other things. If 50% of the net worth really is less than,
yeah,
and I do want to talk about that. I mean, we've talked about these are kind of the caps, but the general standard for a money judgment is compensatory damages plus costs plus estimated interest for the appeal. I usually use kind of 2 years as a round number. That's mm-hmm. There's no magic in that. It can be shorter, it can be longer, but I think rarely does an appeal from institution to end get wrapped up in less than about a year and a half or 2 years. So that's just sort of the figure I generally use. Compensatory means compensatory. It's not exemplary damages. It's not post-judgment interest. It's not attorney's fees, and it's not equitable awards like disgorgement. It really is actual damages, you know, economic, non-economic type damages. So that's the rule. subject to the caps for $25 billion or 50% of net worth. And that's how you figure money judgment. Property judgments are kind of the flip side of that. In property judgments, there's only a floor, there's not caps. So remember, the $25 million and half of net worth don't apply to a property judgment. And for that, if it's a real property judgment, it's the estimated rents or revenue. If it's personal, it's the value of the interest, and it doesn't have judgment interest included in that. And that's a little bit different one, because with a money judgment, if you go and you lose on appeal, they're going to go after your surety bond and get the amount. In a property judgment, there actually has to be kind of a mini trial after the appeal is over if you lose, to prove what they were entitled to as damages. So it's not an automatic entitlement. That's just security for the appeal. Then there's a bucket of these sort of other judgments in the rules. And that's one where the trial court sets the amount itself. You have to go get a finding, sort of like you have to do in property. Those are things like injunctions, turnover orders, an accounting request, those types of orders that aren't really money, they're not really property, they're just something else. In those situations, a creditor can actually post a counter supersedeas and prevent the case from being stayed. And that's, I mean, think about an injunction. You don't want them to be able to stay an injunction. So if you're the judgment creditor, you may want to do counter supersedeas. And just know, if it's a state or local entity, there's some weird rules in Chapter 6 of the CPRC that give them certain rights to stay, don't stay without a bond. Mm-hmm. Take a look at it, because it really does make a difference. And then in the worst case scenario, if you have one that's got money and other and or property, you've got to supersede all three. So
yeah, that counter supersedeas thing, it's a little mind-boggling. And I remember when those cases first came out on the governmental entities being able to essentially counter supersede with no bond. It's a very frustrating position to be in if you're on the other side of that.
It is.
When you're dealing with a private litigant, it's like, all right, they're going to have to pony up. Well, hey, you know, we're the state. We don't have to do that. And by the way, we can counter supersede you just by saying that's what we want to do. And it's, boy, that's one of the things that I think makes litigating against the state or any government entity really challenging. But those, you know, the other type of judgment, you know, money, property, or other, there's a lot of gray area in those others. And, you know, the trial court has a lot of discretion. So that's another area where, you know, you can get into litigating about what net worth is and so forth, but what the supersedeas that's required for those other orders can also lead to a lot of satellite litigation, as you've said.
It definitely can.
And, you know, a TI, I think, you know, an injunction is about the best example I can think of. And I, every so often you come across a lawyer who thinks that, well, it's not a money judgment, so I should just be able to ask the trial court to stay the judgment. Well, now you still have to go by 24.1.
That's right.
You know, that's kind of the default. That's where, you know, the courts are going to look. If they're not looking at 24.1, the next stop is the Court of Appeals to tell the trial court, here's what you got to do, you know, for there to be a supersedeas. So it's, we joke about it being a nerdy area, but there is a lot of appellate work, a lot of cases generated, even from not final judgments in this area. So I think that's one reason why we appellate lawyers enjoy it so much.
No, that's right. And there's, the Texas rules are written in such of a way that there's a lot of different paths you can go down. I mean, particularly, it's not uncommon to see a money judgment coupled with an injunction. That is not at all uncommon. And now you've got two different types that you have to stay. And there's all the issues in it of, okay, well, what's the amount of money? Is it, you know, net worth? Does that apply? What's the other type of judgment? What do we have to do there? And, you know, we can file one thing and stay it, but then the other one, we got to get fined. It's just, it can be a mess, which is why, again, the thing that I have said at the top and we'll keep saying, you got to think about this early. As soon as you think you might have a judgment, just start preparing how you're going to go about it.
I think that's right. And, you know, it's, you kind of look at it, maybe this is a little extreme, but, you know, we preach and the law professors preach things like, you know, look at your jury charge, get your jury charge written before you ever file your lawsuit, or at least before you start discovery. That would be a really early stage to start looking at supersedeas issues. But if you're actually headed to trial, I would start thinking about it. If you've got big time exposure potentially in a judgment, even if you think you're going to win, you know, I don't think it's too much to say that, you know, the lawyer whose client is facing the wrong end of a lot of zeros on a potential judgment really ought to be thinking about, all right, well, you know, if the bottom falls out, how are we going to handle this?
That's right.
And, you know, it's just good planning, if nothing else. And if you do it and the bottom does fall out, then your client's not going to be happy, but you're at least going to, you know, be able to show them that, look, all is not lost. We can supersede this judgment, and you're now prepared. I've been talking to your accounting people, and, you know, here's what we're going to do. You have a strategy going in, because, you know, we do have that little weird it's not weird, but little 30-day period where nothing really happens on the enforceability of a judgment. You know, that 30 days can go by really quick. And
it does.
30 days might not be enough time to get all your ducks in a row to get a judgment stayed.
That's exactly right. And it can get complicated. Yeah. And, you know, at least when you know you've got a verdict against you, start thinking about it and figuring out the different ways it could go and the different ways, because some of that, I think, is part of the business case that a client has to make decisions on and what to appeal, whether to appeal, how to appeal, because you think about the cost of the appeal and the attorney's fees to do that, but it's not at all uncommon for some of these supersedious issues to create their own sideshow where the cost can easily run into the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars pretty quickly.
It's a case within a case, you know.
It absolutely is.
Kind of like malpractice cases.
Mm-hmm.
I should also mention, I mentioned the 30-day period, though. This is also a good time to know, you know, what you have to do to extend some of the deadlines, not only plenary jurisdiction, but also the enforceability of the judgment. If you've got a motion for a new trial on file, then you defer that 30-day period. So that's another tool in the toolbox for somebody who's looking to avoid a judgment becoming enforceable. That's not really the subject of our talk today, but I think the overall point is, you know, you got to know what tools are available to you, but don't let that lull you to sleep and have you thinking you got time. If things go south, because time can be of the essence.
Well, and even that rule extends the deadline on things like writs of execution, but it doesn't necessarily stop post-judgment discovery, abstracts of judgment, garnishment, turnover. You know, there's still a host of bad things that can happen even when it's extended by a new trial.
That's true. That is true. And don't sleep on turnover and receivership, because that's the one that even if you have the means to supersede, that turnover order can get signed really quick if you're not careful. And next thing you know, your client's getting all these information demands from the receiver and you better get that judgment superseded, because there's nothing else that's going to stop.
Exactly right. I will throw out there for those people that do family law, there is a specific subsection on custody and conservatorship. There's bonds for that. Typically the default is it doesn't get suspended, but there's room for that if that comes to an issue. So just be aware that's out there. And then on the amount, no matter what type of judgment, there is kind of a catch-all that you can attempt to do, which is called substantial economic harm. And that applies regardless of what it is, but just like net worth, well, not like net worth, just like alternative security, you've got to have a hearing, you've got to put on evidence, and you've got to get a finding, and the court's got to set the judgment amount at an amount that won't cause substantial economic harm to the judgment debtor. And there's so many different factors. It's really mushy fuzzy. The trial court has a lot of discretion, but think of this as it's basically going to throw your business in bankruptcy, or it's going to require you to substantially liquidate your assets, or it's going to prevent you from being able to maintain your ongoing business operations. Those types of things are where you see substantial economic harm coming into the equation.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had made a note to bring it up. I don't think I've read a ton of cases applying that standard. I don't know that it does seem like it's a really narrow application. I mean, because otherwise everybody would use it, right? It's not a get out of jail free card. And so I would be curious to know, like, maybe next time we talk about supersedious on the show, maybe we can dive into the issue of, well, what is substantial economic harm? You pointed out that there are some specific standards for it, and I think that's helpful. But I'm just trying to envision the situation. You've given a few examples, and I think that's helpful. But if your client sees that standard in the rule, you know, that's probably what they're going to point to and say, well, what about this? If you're not able to give them the answers that they're asking, or to the questions that they're asking, or ChatGPT is helping them to ask. So that's another area where, you know, there's a lot of gray.
Yeah. And I've looked at this in several different cases over the years, and it's so fact intensive, and the trial court has a lot of discretion as the fact finder on this. So you just have to look at the cases. And I think we're going to post my paper on our show notes. There's some cases in there cited that have some of the different standards that courts have applied, but it is what it sounds like. It's substantial economic harm. It's got to be some sort of problem that's going to prevent your normal business or life operations effectively is kind of a very broad distilled standard. So
yeah, you talked about the trial court's discretion. I think that's a very important point to highlight, and that, you know, there is a right of appellate review on a trial court's decision on supersedious. If, you know, you think the trial judge got it wrong on saying that, no, your net worth is really $10 million and not, you know, $10 or negative, That can be taken up as part of the appeal, but you're going to have to overcome that standard of whatever facts the trial court wound up finding. You know, they're going to be reviewed just essentially like any other fact finding that the Court of Appeals would be reviewing that would be made by a trial court. And so it's, the review is possible, but it is, you know, just objectively stated, it's a difficult standard to overcome. If there's any evidence to support, you know, if the trial court had evidence to base its discretionary decision on, it's going to get affirmed. So
that's right.
And that can be an appeal in and of itself too. We talked about the satellite litigation, you know, appeal motions to review trial court's net worth determination can be as, you know, as involved as an ordinary appeal on the substantive legal issues.
No doubt. Cause you have to have a separate record and you've got to have a separate brief, because it truly is a motion. You have to file a motion that's effectively a brief, and then the other side responds, then you do a reply, and then the court decides it. And then from there, you've got to go up to the Texas Supreme Court on mandamus as a literal original proceeding if you don't like that. So it's, although the one thing that is different is because it's based out of the rules, you don't have to have an adequate remedy problem to get mandamus to the Texas Supreme Court, but you've still got to litigate the merits. So it's, it can take a whole lot of time, effort, and money to get that looked at.
I had to do one of these within about the last year, and that's the exact path I had to follow. And it's like, you know, every other, it's essentially like a mandamus, even though it's a motion for review. It's every bit as intense as a full blown mandamus, you know, live or die situation.
That's right.
Even in the motion for review stage. And then you switch gears and start framing it in terms of mandamus terminology when you get to the Supreme Court. And, you know, that's, you really want that resolved in your favor, you know, in the trial court, if at all possible. But you know, your best shot after that's the Court of Appeals, because we've still got a Supreme Court with completely discretionary review. If there's something important, you know, you'd want to think they'd take a look at it. But it is amazing. I just, the theme just keeps coming up that, you know, these can sort of sprout into their own animals. I'm really mixing up my metaphors today.
They sprout into animals.
These can, you know, branch off and turn into significant litigation issues in and of themselves. And so, hopefully, you know, if you're going to trial and you go to the point of getting a judgment, your client's got the stomach to continue to litigate these issues when it's appropriate to do that.
That's right.
Because if there's legitimate reason to litigate this stuff, then, you know, great. That's what the law is and that's what it's for. Mm-hmm. But, you know, take a hard look at the positions that your client's going to take. Cause it, you know, if you don't win in the trial court, it's not looking good for you after that.
That's right.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
I think another thing to keep in mind is if things change during the course of the appeal, the trial court still has the power to look at it. So I mentioned 2 years of interest. Well, what happens if you are 2 years and 4 months into the case and the bond posted 2 years worth of interest? Well, if you're the judgment creditor, you can go back to the trial court and say, hey, make them put more in. Mm-hmm. It's been too long.
Yep.
And the trial court has power to do that. One other thing in the Graystar case that came out recently was there's this sort of catch-all 24.1E rule that says, well, the court can make other orders to protect the creditor. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it does say that, but that's sort of cabined in by what it's allowed to do as part of its review of supersedious amounts. And so it can't go outside of those standards under the idea of other orders. So like there, the court had ruled on the bond and said, well, you didn't post enough, therefore all the bonds are invalid. And, you know, immediately now the judgment is unsecured. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that doesn't work. That's not one of the powers that you have. And they also said that the sort of de facto standard, if a trial court does something that changes your, what you're required to post, there's a 20-day stay.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be shortened, it can be lengthened, but the de facto there is going to be 20 days. So basically, if the trial court makes a new order, a reasonable time period that you have to post the new security or comply with it is 20 days. And then there's arguments either side can make. So we don't know what that's going to look like, but I do want to point out that that's a little bit different. And then the other, you mentioned what's new.
Yeah.
The other thing that changed in the statute or in the rule is if you go up on appeal, the rule used to be You had to go all the way through the Texas Supreme Court as the judgment debtor, and you had to keep your bond in place, and that didn't get to change. Mm-hmm. 24.2F changed a couple of years ago, and now if you go to the Intermediate Court of Appeals and you prevail, you can go back to the trial court, even if the other side is seeking review at the Texas Supreme Court, or both of you are, and get your bond reduced. So if you get a reverse and render or a reverse mm-hmm. and remand, the trial court now has the ability to look at that and say, okay, well, you no longer have to supersede the trial court's original judgment for whatever that amount was or whatever the property or other judgment. And that can be a huge deal because yes. Texas Supreme Court proceedings can take another couple of years potentially. So you may be off the hook for supersedious bond premiums.
Yeah, that's a huge change and a good one. I think for the cases that justify it, if you convince the Court of Appeals that the trial court got it wrong, that you ought not to be stuck with what the trial court did on supersedious. Mm-hmm. It's just common sense.
That's right. And there's still discretion in there. And I think where we're going to really see some interesting cases, and there just isn't really case law on this, is what happens when the Court of Appeals affirms some, reverses some, maybe remands some. I mean, how do you deal with that? And I don't have the answer, but I think it's going to raise some interesting questions that are going to have to get litigated by appellate and trial lawyers in the trial court.
There's always, need for things to get percolated.
And that's right.
It's how the law develops. And it's as messy as it is.
Mm-hmm. So we can talk about whatever else you want to talk about, but those are kind of the big things that I've seen and the big things that I wanted to raise up today. There's all kinds of little things in the rules and all sorts of weird other quirky things that can come up. But I think my big takeaway, of course, is just give yourself time, give yourself options, because I'm sure Todd has had this happen. It's happened to me too. You get a call where it's the 11th hour and someone says, hey, what do I do to supersede this judgment? Mm-hmm. Somebody that you've never talked to before, and you're having to jump in and do what you can do, but there's only so much you can do unless your client just happens to luckily have a huge amount of cash laying around. Then you've got to figure out where to go.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't think I really have anything to add to your discussion today. I think the paper is really good. Let me just refer to the references that we're going to drop in the show notes. And so there's your article in the Appellate Advocate. I still love the title. Early on, episode 35, we had Dan Huckabee, who leads Court Surety Bond Agency, who's, full disclosure, a sponsor of the show. That was a really good discussion. I remember that episode well. You and I did an episode in 123 for a few years ago about the rule changes when they came out. This is mm-hmm. kind of a nice update to that. And you're definitely the authoritative one between the two of us on these issues right now. So I like being able to ask these questions of you. It's a little different approach to how we do things. And then you mentioned Arturo Ayala, who's a mainstay at our Texas CLE, appellate CLE programs, mm-hmm. also from Court Surety Bond Agency. And Arturo's episode actually has gotten a lot of traction for us. If you look at our YouTube channel, it is by far the most viewed episode that we've done.
Good.
So I need to give a hat tip to Arturo there, and not just because they're a sponsor of the show. But so I guess, as we wrap up, I'll probe you, Jody, for any other, either a tip or a war story about supersedious issues that you've experienced in your practice.
I guess my tip/war story is don't give up. I had a case I was involved in where we had two different motions to review. The first one was unsuccessful. We went back down, ended up making some different arguments, finding some additional evidence, putting it in the record, and went back the second time. And the second time, the Court of Appeals agreed with us that the trial court had erred in its rulings on supersedious and preventing us from being able to supersede the judgment. So we were able to go back down and get the trial court to issue orders that permitted that. And unfortunately for everyone, it cost both sides a tremendous amount of money to get to the point where probably everyone should have been at the first place. And so, again, think about it early, see if you can find a way for everyone to work it out. But even if you can't, just be prepared, because it may take that in some cases, because that may be the only way to prevent your client from harm. There's, of course, if you go through this whole process, they execute, they take your property, and then you win on appeal, there is a remedy for that. But the problem is, if the judgment creditor doesn't have the assets anymore, then you can't get those assets back. Or if they don't have the ability to actually pay the judgment or the damages that you get for that. So just, there's just a lot to think about.
100%. I don't really have anything concrete. I think the one thing I would say, coming at this from a little bit different angle, is when these issues start to pop up, or it looks like they're going to pop up, it's probably a good idea to review your engagement agreement with the client, because you can spend, as we've said, lots and lots of time litigating these things. And if you've got a narrow scope drawn out in your engagement letter, it might be time to amend your engagement letter with the client, because, you know, as we pointed out, we appellate lawyers, we're not necessarily used to dealing with discovery and depositions and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think a responsible appellate lawyer might say, hey, I'll work with you on all the briefing and all that stuff, but you really need to continue to engage your trial counsel to handle this discovery stuff, because it's kind of outside my wheelhouse.
That's right.
I mean, I can do it, but is it the best use of your resources as somebody who's paying a lawyer to assist them in this situation? And yeah, that also depends, of course, on the size of your practice. For me, it's not terribly practical as a solo to have to deal with discovery and all of that. For other folks, you know, larger firms, that maybe it's just a matter of going down the hall and, you know, finding somebody who, even if they didn't work on the case before, is equipped to do that. And this is something that would be in their comfort zone. So I think my tip when it comes to these issues is just check your engagement letter. Make sure the work that you're doing is within the scope. And if it's not, you might look at adjusting the scope of your letter or associating someone to help with these issues, because they can take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And it takes, if you don't know how to do it out of the gate, it takes a long time to learn.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, net worth challenges, property judgments, other judgments, substantial economic harm, every single one of those requires an evidentiary hearing where you have to put on witnesses, documents, potentially deposition testimony. I mean, you know, if as an appellate lawyer, that's not your thing, then you need to make sure that there's somebody who can and will do that, whether it's trial counsel or somebody else. So,
right. So, I think that kind of fits together with the way we like to approach cases and what we talk about on the show is just, you know, you maintain a good working relationship with your trial counsel. If the case has been referred to you, you might tell them you're not necessarily off the hook.
That's right. That's right.
So it's a good opportunity and they'll appreciate you more, I think, and maybe in most cases, for if there's ever a perception that you're, you know, just trying to take the work or take the client, it's like, no, I'm going to give this back to you.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Jody, thanks for filling us in on the latest and greatest on Supersedious. And we'll be back next time to talk about the final rules for the petition for review system and what we've been able to cull out from what's been happening over the last 6 months or so there.
Sounds good.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by Law Pods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.